Listening test. Task 1. You are going to listen to a recording about beekeeping. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for each question, 1 to 7. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Well, honeybees are disappearing globally at an alarming rate. It's due to pesticides, parasites, disease, and habitat loss. Now, the EU has restricted the use of so-called neonicotinoid insecticides. Now, these have been partly blamed for the dramatic decline in bee populations. However, many farmers say that the insecticides are vital to prevent crops from being destroyed by pests. Well, Rosie Waite spoke to Walter Hifecker. He's president of the European Professional Beekeepers Association. And he says more needs to be done to ban dangerous pesticides.
Beekeepers were the first to find out that there was something wrong with the approval of these pesticides. After a long process, we have a partial ban. This ban should be expanded. We need to look at how was it possible for these products to get approved in the first place. The scientists at the EFSA, European Food Safety Authority, have gone through the process of re-evaluating these testing methods. They've made a proposal how to improve them, and now it's up to the politicians to actually enact this. Industry wants to water down this process because they're afraid that if these products are being tested properly, they might not enter the market at all.
And why should we be concerned and worried about the future of the bees? Would we actually starve if there were no bees?
There is a fair number of crops that simply depend on pollination by honeybees or their wild relatives. And those are crops that make our food healthy and diverse. Honeybees are a success story over millions of years through all kinds of climate change and whatnot. They've been a very resilient species. So if we manage to mess up our ecosystems to the points that even the honeybees are in trouble, that is a warning signal that we should take seriously.
And it seems like it's relatively easy to get a beehive and keep bees in your garden. Do you think that people need to be properly trained and to be more knowledgeable?
There are new beekeepers joining the beekeeping community that don't want to keep many hives, that have the idea that maybe I don't even need the honey. I just want to provide space for bees so that they're out there in the garden pollinating. And this is a way of beekeeping that is simply not possible because you need to be trained enough to really take care of the bees. So if you are somebody that wants to do something positive for the bees, there is another possibility where you create habitat, you create nesting places, and you'll be surprised how many bees will actually just show up and be out there pollinating your garden.
That's Walter Hifecker. He's president of the European Professional Beekeepers Association. Thank you. Well, honeybees are disappearing globally at an alarming rate. It's due to pesticides, parasites, disease and habitat loss. Now, the EU has restricted the use of so-called neonicotinoid insecticides. Now, these have been partly blamed for the dramatic decline in bee populations. However, many farmers say that the insecticides are vital to prevent crops from being destroyed by pests. Well, Rosie Waite spoke to Walter Hifecker. He's president of the European Professional Beekeepers Association. And he says more needs to be done to ban dangerous pesticides.
Beekeepers were the first to find out that there was something wrong with the approval of these pesticides. After a long process, we have a partial ban. This ban should be expanded. We need to look at how was it possible for these products to get approved in the first place. The scientists at the EFSA, European Food Safety Authority, have gone through the process of re-evaluating these testing methods. They've made a proposal how to improve them, and now it's up to the politicians to actually enact this. Industry wants to water down this process because they're afraid that if these products are being tested properly, they might not enter the market at all.
And why should we be concerned and worried about the future of the bees? Would we actually starve if there were no bees?
There is a fair number of crops that simply depend on pollination by honeybees or their wild relatives. And those are crops that make our food healthy and diverse. Honeybees are a success story over millions of years through all kinds of climate change and whatnot. They've been a very resilient species. So if we manage to mess up our ecosystems to the points that even the honeybees are in trouble, that is a warning signal that we should take seriously.
And it seems like it's relatively easy to get a beehive and keep bees in your garden. Do you think that people need to be properly trained and to be more knowledgeable?
There are new beekeepers joining the beekeeping community that don't want to keep many hives, that have the idea that maybe I don't even need the honey. I just want to provide space for bees so that they're out there in the garden pollinating. And this is a way of beekeeping that is simply not possible because you need to be trained enough to really take care of the bees. So if you are somebody that wants to do something positive for the bees, there is another possibility where you create habitat, you create nesting places, and you'll be surprised how many bees will actually just show up and be out there pollinating your garden.
That's Walter Hifecker. He's president of the European Professional Beekeepers Association.
Task 2. You are going to listen to a recording about people living in a dry region. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, answer the questions 1 to 7 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Let's go now to a tiny community tucked in the heart of California's Central Valley. It's a place where people have been living with very little water for a very long time and still face increasing water bills. As NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports, some low-income residents there worry that if they can't pay their water bills, the county could shut off their taps.
On a dusty single-lane road about an hour west of Fresno, there's a small rustic mom-and-pop store selling not much more than beer, soda, and chips. We're in a remote rural community called Cantua Creek, surrounded by orchards and fallow fields. The owner, Leticia Fernandez, is a small, vivacious woman who says her store has seen better times.
I mean, we used to have produce and milk. Deliveries were here every week. Now, twice a month.
Fernandez blames a drought. Customers disappeared as local ranchers didn't bother to plant row crops for lack of water. No farm workers, no customers, says Fernandez.
So that means that the people that live here now, we have to look for jobs elsewhere.
Fernandez says the drought made matters worse by making the cost of water unaffordable. And here's where the story gets complicated. Cantua Creek is a small community of about 400 residents. They are mostly older, retired, or disabled farm workers on fixed incomes. Their water supply is passed through the local water district to Fresno County. Recently, that district tripled the price of water. County officials tried to raise water fees in Cantua Creek by about $30 per month to cover the increase. But the community said no. Even if you have to shut the water off by May, we can't afford it.
Why? Because the water that we're receiving there is not water that is treated enough for us to drink it. So the only way we use that water is either to wash dishes, clothes, or take a shower.
They already shell out an additional $6 per 5-gallon jug of drinking water. So the notion of paying more for water they can't even drink is especially upsetting. That leaves Fresno County officials scrambling for a solution that could include consolidating future water supplies for several small communities to bring down the price. Officials say the county is in no position to pay for Cantua Creek's water. The residents have to pay for themselves. Fresno County Supervisor Henry Perea says the county has no legal obligation to help the residents of Cantua Creek, but he says,
the question is for us politically is, are we really going to let these folks just basically wither on the vine?
Last week, word spread that the state of California would step in with short-term drought emergency funds, about $120,000, to help Cantua Creek pay its water bill. James Mahan is an assistant deputy director for financial assistance at the State Water Resources Control Board. He says the state aid comes with strings.
They've got to reduce the amount of water that they're using because it is very expensive.
Back in Cantua Creek, Leticia Fernandez says she and her neighbors are already conserving. They've installed low-flow shower heads, limited flushing, no water for gardens or washing cars. Then she points to her brown lawn.
Don't you think that's conserving already? We're not drinking it. So what else do they want us to do with this water?
As the drought's grip tightens, that question is being posed in more communities facing a dwindling supply of water.
Let's go now to a tiny community tucked in the heart of California's Central Valley. It's a place where people have been living with very little water for a very long time and still face increasing water bills. As NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports, some low-income residents there worry that if they can't pay their water bills, the county could shut off their taps.
On a dusty single-lane road about an hour west of Fresno, there's a small rustic mom-and-pop store selling not much more than beer, soda, and chips. We're in a remote rural community called Cantua Creek, surrounded by orchards and fallow fields. The owner, Leticia Fernandez, is a small, vivacious woman who says her store has seen better times.
I mean, we used to have produce and milk. Deliveries were here every week. Now, twice a month.
Fernandez blames a drought. Customers disappeared as local ranchers didn't bother to plant row crops for lack of water. No farm workers, no customers, says Fernandez.
So that means that the people that live here now, we have to look for jobs elsewhere.
Fernandez says the drought made matters worse by making the cost of water unaffordable, and here's where the story gets complicated. Cantua Creek is a small community of about 400 residents. They are mostly older, retired, or disabled farm workers on fixed incomes. Their water supply is passed through the local water district to Fresno County. Recently, that district tripled the price of water. County officials tried to raise water fees in Cantua Creek by about $30 per month to cover the increase. But the community said no. Even if you have to shut the water off by May, we can't afford it.
Why? Because the water that we're receiving there is not water that is treated enough for us to drink it. So the only way we use that water is either to wash dishes, clothes, or take a shower.
They already shell out an additional $6 per 5-gallon jug of drinking water. So the notion of paying more for water they can't even drink is especially upsetting. That leaves Fresno County officials scrambling for a solution that could include consolidating future water supplies for several small communities to bring down the price. Officials say the county is in no position to pay for Cantua Creek's water. The residents have to pay for themselves. Fresno County Supervisor Henry Perea says the county has no legal obligation to help the residents of Cantua Creek, but he says,
the question is for us politically is, are we really going to let these folks just basically wither on the vine?
Last week, word spread that the state of California would step in with short-term drought emergency funds, about $120,000, to help Cantua Creek pay its water bill. James Mahan is an assistant deputy director for financial assistance at the State Water Resources Control Board. He says the state aid comes with strings.
They've got to reduce the amount of water that they're using because it is very expensive.
Back in Cantua Creek, Leticia Fernandez says she and her neighbors are already conserving. They've installed low-flow shower heads, limited flushing, no water for gardens or washing cars. Then she points to her brown lawn.
Don't you think that's conserving already? We're not drinking it. So what else do they want us to do with this water?
As the drought's grip tightens, that question is being posed in more communities facing a dwindling supply of water.
Task 3. You are going to listen to a recording about stress. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences, 1 to 10, with the sentence endings, A to M. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
I seem to be reading that people are more stressed than ever before. I hear it all the time. But is that really true, or is that just something we like to say?
No, I think it really is true. I mean, if you just take a look at the workplace, Muscular skeletal diseases was the main cause of sickness absence in the UK for decades. Now it is the common mental disorders of depression, anxiety, and stress. They are now the leading cause of sickness absence, not just in the UK workforce, by the way, but throughout the developed world. You'll see that in the EU, in EU countries, in North America. It is now the leading cause.
Okay, I understand that in the workplace, as jobs have changed, so have the reasons for sickness, from physical problems to mental ones. But are there actually any stats to back this up?
Well, this is a slightly tricky one. As Kairi said, people have only been studying stress since the 50s, so it's still a relatively new field scientifically, and there haven't been many studies looking at a change in population health. But what there has been has brought in, well, I think some quite alarming statistics. When asking, are we getting more stressed? Universities have reported a 10% increase in uptake of their counselling services year on year, with mental health problems on campus raising from 8,000 to 18,000 cases in just 4 years.
Wow, that's quite a lot.
Yeah, I was looking for studies and I came across this one and was really quite surprised. And then in terms of really big numbers, in 2014, the charity Mind, the mental health charity, found that 56% of the workers they polled reported workplace stress, which is really a crazy amount.
Sorry, I'm a bit speechless. 56% is a staggering amount. But I wonder, is there a difference between stress and just, you know, having a lot on your plate?
Yeah. Absolutely. And so when does stress become a problem? And actually, this is something I ask Kairi, the difference between pressure and stress.
People will say, I'm stressed. Basically, when they say that, just generally, they mean they're under pressure. By the way, pressure is stimulating and motivating. But when pressure exceeds your ability to cope, then you're in the stress arena. And when that happens, you'll get ill health consequences.
And if we are more stressed, you mentioned that the types of jobs we're doing have changed, but also a lot of other things have changed about the world that we live in now. So what's causing this increased stress?
Oh, there's a variety of things. First of all, technological advance is much faster than ever before. People have been more mobile. Think about it. 30 or 40 years ago, people worked within a radius of 30 miles of where they lived. They had the community around them. They had their extended family. We don't have the extended family anymore. We don't have the natural counselors in our environment, the aunties, the grandmas, the neighbors who knew four generations of your family, who were people you could go talk to because we weren't mobile. But now people are looking for jobs. They're moving away from their extended family. And basically, we're now into just the mother, the father, the kids. So we don't have now the kind of support systems that we had then. And really, the insecurity in society generally now. Jobs are no longer for life, and we're working longer hours. If you take the UK, we have the longest working hours in the developed world behind the United States.
You talked about connectivity, but connectivity through technology, we are constantly switched on and constantly available. We talk about relationships, but it's a very different type of relationship, that, isn't it?
Yeah, what's also happening, I think, is not only the speed of technology and the constant change that we're undergoing as a major kind of outside source of stress on people, but think about information and communication technologies. Just think about email. Email is overloading people. Through mobile technology, it's making people on 724. And in fact, it's interesting that many employers now are closing down their servers at the weekend because people are accessing it too often, some at night. The technology has gone so fast that we're not in control of it. It's in control of us.
I seem to be reading that people are more stressed than ever before. I hear it all the time. But is that really true, or is that just something we like to say?
No, I think it really is true. I mean, if you just take a look at the workplace, muscular skeletal diseases was the main cause of sickness absence in the UK for decades. Now it is the common mental disorders of depression, anxiety, and stress. They are now the leading cause of sickness absence, not just in the UK workforce, by the way, but throughout the developed world. You'll see that in the EU, in EU countries, in North America. It is now the leading cause.
Okay, I understand that in the workplace, as jobs have changed, so have the reasons for sickness, from physical problems to mental ones. But are there actually any stats to back this up?
Well, this is a slightly tricky one. As Kerry said, people have only been studying stress since the 50s, so it's still a relatively new field scientifically, and there haven't been many studies looking at a change in population health. But what there has been has brought in, well, I think some quite alarming statistics. When asking, are we getting more stressed? Universities have reported a 10% increase in uptake of their counselling services year on year, with mental health problems on campus raising from 8,000 to 18,000 cases in just 4 years.
Wow, that's quite a lot.
Yeah, I was looking for studies and I came across this one and was really quite surprised. And then in terms of really big numbers, in 2014, the charity Mind, the mental health charity, found that 56% of the workers they polled reported workplace stress, which is really a crazy amount.
Sorry, I'm a bit speechless. 56% is a staggering amount. But I wonder, is there a difference between stress and just, you know, having a lot on your plate?
Yeah. Absolutely. And so when does stress become a problem? And actually, this is something I asked Kerry, the difference between pressure and stress.
People will say, I'm stressed. Basically, when they say that, just generally, they mean they're under pressure. By the way, pressure is stimulating and motivating. But when pressure exceeds your ability to cope, then you're in the stress arena. And when that happens, you'll get ill health consequences.
And if we are more stressed, you mentioned that the types of jobs we're doing have changed, but also a lot of other things have changed about the world that we live in now. So what's causing this increased stress?
Oh, there's a variety of things. First of all, technological advance is much faster than ever before. People have been more mobile. Think about it. 30 or 40 years ago, people worked within a radius of 30 miles of where they lived. They had the community around them. They had their extended family. We don't have the extended family anymore. We don't have the natural counselors in our environment, the aunties, the grandmas, the neighbors who knew four generations of your family, who were people you could go talk to because we weren't mobile. But now people are looking for jobs. They're moving away from their extended family. And basically, we're now into just the mother, the father, the kids. So we don't have now the kind of support systems that we had then. And really, the insecurity in society generally now. Jobs are no longer for life, and we're working longer hours. If you take the UK, we have the longest working hours in the developed world behind the United States.
You talked about connectivity, but connectivity through technology, we are constantly switched on and constantly available. We talk about relationships, but it's a very different type of relationship, that, isn't it?
Yeah, what's also happening, I think, is not only the speed of technology and the constant change that we're undergoing as a major kind of outside source of stress on people, but think about information and communication technologies. Just think about email. Email is overloading people. Through mobile technology, it's making people on 724. And in fact, it's interesting that many employers now are closing down their servers at the weekend because people are accessing it too often, some at night. The technology has gone so fast that we're not in control of it. It's in control of us.
Task 4. You are going to listen to the first part of an interview with sociologist Frank Ferrady. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for each question, 1 to 7. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
There's a crisis in adult authority in our schools. That's the view of British sociologist Frank Furedi, the author of many provocative books, including The Politics of Fear, Therapy Culture, and Paranoid Parenting. Now he's turned his attention to education in a new book called Wasted, Why Education Isn't Educating. He advocates a change in the relationship between teachers and students.
Well, I think at the moment, teachers are encouraged to regard themselves as not only the leaders or the guides of students, but rather as facilitators, as people who are just there. So, for example, quite often you have in England a situation where headmasters call themselves head learners and pretend that they're just, you know, a more older learner, a biologically mature learner compared to the child. And there's a real sense of evading the fact that at the end of the day, you're there in the classroom as a teacher, and it's your job to educate those kids.
Yeah. Isn't it, to an extent, part of a wider societal change in how the generations relate? Respecting your elders has sort of been replaced with less hierarchy and the idea that we all have equal status, in a way.
I think that's very much the case, that in general, adults are estranged from giving a lead to children, and most grown-up people are discouraged from engaging with other people's children, telling them what to do. So, whereas when I was a child, you know, quite often strangers would tell me, don't do this or don't do that, or encourage me or discourage me. Now we're too scared to do anything like that with other people's children.
Same when I was a child too, absolutely. So it's not just teachers, although we'll come back to teachers, but parents often struggle to assert authority.
That's right, and it's interesting because, you know, when I was traveling in the United States a couple of months ago, I came across a leaflet that was being handed out in a small town in upstate New York, which told local officials how to behave when they see children and parents arguing. And the idea was that they had to take the side of the child against the parent and tell the parent to be quiet and not to reprimand your child. And I thought that's a complete reversal of the natural order of things. The fact that you as a government official would be backing the child against the parent rather than back up adults to make sure that, you know, the adult world is able to transmit to young kids their values and their beliefs.
So has that become a radical idea, that adults should be in charge, that of its nature it's an unequal relationship?
Well, even more fundamentally, a radical idea is that adults should take themselves seriously and not infantilize themselves and think of themselves as being just biologically mature, but not morally different than children.
So you've talked to a lot of teachers, I know, and parents and students for the new book. Why are teachers having trouble exerting authority?
Well, there's two big problems. One is that teachers are not allowed to get on with the job. And we live in a world where parents are so obsessed with living their lives through children that they're continually bombarding teachers with helpful advice. And the level of parental intervention in European schools is phenomenal, to the point at which if little Mary doesn't get on the netball team because she can barely move, her parents will come and say, why isn't Mary on the team? And fairly soon Mary will be on the netball team. So you have that kind of parental intervention. And then secondly, teachers are discouraged from exercising authority, from disciplining children, from giving them a lead. So for example, if a child's given a detention, I mean, these days that's seen as an unusual tragedy that shouldn't be done in many schools, and therefore they lose the ability to guide children in a purposeful way.
Well, and that's another issue where you can see parental intervention, can't you? Where a child can be punished because that child has transgressed the rules of the school, but determined parental intervention can see teachers and schools backing down.
Absolutely, and what I find in my interviews is that in the abstract, most parents want teachers to be authoritative and disciplined kids, but not their own child. So they often point out to teachers, why don't you do something about that child or this child? But my child's an angel, and you mustn't do anything that in any sense sends negative signals.
There's a crisis in adult authority in our schools. That's the view of British sociologist Frank Faridi, the author of many provocative books, including The Politics of Fear, Therapy Culture, and Paranoid Parenting. Now he's turned his attention to education in a new book called Wasted, Why Education Isn't Educating. He advocates a change in the relationship between teachers and students.
Well, I think at the moment, teachers are encouraged to regard themselves as not really the leaders or the guides of students, but rather as facilitators, as people who are just there. So, for example, quite often you have in England a situation where headmasters call themselves head learners and pretend that they're just, you know, a more older learner, a biologically mature learner compared to the child. And there's a real sense of evading the fact that at the end of the day, you're there in the classroom as a teacher, and it's your job to educate those kids.
Yeah. Isn't it, to an extent, part of a wider societal change in how the generations relate? Respecting your elders has sort of been replaced with less hierarchy and the idea that we all have equal status, in a way.
I think that's very much the case, that in general, adults are estranged from giving a lead to children, and most grown-up people are discouraged from engaging with other people's children, telling them what to do. So, whereas when I was a child, you know, quite often strangers would tell me, don't do this or don't do that, or encourage me or discourage me. Now we're too scared to do anything like that with other people's children.
Same when I was a child too, absolutely. So it's not just teachers, although we'll come back to teachers, but parents often struggle to assert authority.
That's right, and it's interesting because, you know, when I was traveling in the United States a couple of months ago, I came across a leaflet that was being handed out in a small town in upstate New York, which told local officials how to behave when they see children and parents arguing. And the idea was that they had to take the side of the child against the parent and tell the parent to be quiet and not to reprimand your child. And I thought that's a complete reversal of the natural order of things. The fact that you as a government official would be backing the child against the parent rather than back up adults to make sure that, you know, the adult world is able to transmit to young kids their values and their beliefs.
So has that become a radical idea, that adults should be in charge, that of its nature it's an unequal relationship?
Well, even more fundamentally, a radical idea is that adults should take themselves seriously and not infantilize themselves and think of themselves as being just biologically mature, but not morally different than children.
So you've talked to a lot of teachers, I know, and parents and students for the new book. Why are teachers having trouble exerting authority?
Well, there's two big problems. One is that teachers are not allowed to get on with the job. And we live in a world where parents are so obsessed with living their lives through children that they're continually bombarding teachers with helpful advice. And the level of parental intervention in European schools is phenomenal, to the point at which if little Mary doesn't get on the netball team because she can barely move, her parents will come and say, why isn't Mary on the team? And fairly soon Mary will be on the netball team. So you have that kind of parental intervention. And then secondly, teachers are discouraged from exercising authority, from disciplining children, from giving them a lead. So for example, if a child's given a detention, I mean, these days that's seen as an unusual tragedy that shouldn't be done in many schools, and therefore they lose the ability to guide children in a purposeful way.
Well, and that's another issue where you can see parental intervention, can't you? Where a child can be punished because that child has transgressed at the rules of the school, but determined parental intervention can see teachers and schools backing down.
Absolutely, and what I find in my interviews is that in the abstract, most parents want teachers to be authoritative and disciplined kids, but not their own child. So they often point out to teachers, why don't you do something about that child or this child? But my child's an angel, and you mustn't do anything that in any sense sends negative signals.
This is the end of the listening test.